Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm pleased to have as my guest Andrew Holleran, whose most recent book is Grief. It's published by Hyperion. He began, of course, with the novel Dancer from the Dance. It was followed by Nights in Aruba. There's a book of essays about AIDS and culture that had appeared originally in Christopher Street called Ground Zero, a novel called The Beauty of Men, a book of short stories called In September, The Light Changes, The Stories of Andrew Holleran, and now Grief. These books have been a series of Aklef books, in a sense, yes? Romans Aklef?
I think so. I think the first one, Dancer from the Dance, was probably the most imagined, although it was certainly about my life, the life I was leading in New York. Ground Zero, yes. Nights in Aruba, yes, to the point where I thought that book possibly could have been a memoir, and that always bothered me. And right up to the present. I would say the exception might be In September, The Light Changes. Those were pretty imagined, too. But one of the wonderful things that I read about Proust somewhere was that Proust felt or said that he couldn't make things up. And so while you feel guilty sometimes as a writer for not being more of a Harry Potter kind of writer where you just make up whole cloth, my taste has always been for a kind of autobiographical fiction. And when I was still in high school and was reading Scott Fitzgerald for class, I remember when I found out that his life resembled Tender as a Night, I thought, well, gee, he's not a writer then. He didn't make anything up. But that's the kind of writing I love. I want the writing to be invested with some kind of personal experience and emotion.
Now, I know that from the essays that during the onslaught of the AIDS epidemic and when you were writing those columns for Christopher Street, there was the huge requirement on the one hand that you not sadden those people fighting the disease and those people giving them help, and on the other hand that the stories of deaths were pouring in and were so similar that it required a real virtuosity to find ways to write about this each time so that the pathos and the search for hope would be made possible in the writing. What I find impressive about the two more recent novels is that they have a commitment to a certain kind of truthful somberness. And I wondered whether that was a hard decision to make.
You're right about the things that one worried about when writing in the 80s about AIDS. I think there's an essay in Ground Zero, I think, called Reading and Writing, which I think raises that issue, that how can you write for two audiences, one that needs hope and the other that needs some kind of recognition of the dangers. And I was recently home in Florida, and I took out all my Christopher Street essays from the closet, and I started going through them, and I was struck by the fact that I was, as you say, doing the same thing over and over and over again, but in different ways. And for a while during the 80s, I remember thinking, I've just become a professional elegy writer. I was just writing one elegy for a dead friend after another. And now that AIDS is in a certain degree behind us in terms of distance, what you said is also true. I think now you don't have to be nervous about being somber. You don't have to be anything except what you really feel, because that kind of immediate heightened sense of whom am I disheartening with this essay that's gone? So you can be more frankly somber if that's the way you feel.
What I liked particularly about grief is that I know this will sound paradoxical, but I like its colorlessness. It's lit white. It takes place in Washington. Washington at night frequently in the brightly lit areas of the monuments and the museums and the government buildings. And it's about an experience that doesn't have a very colored presence. It's about grief, precipitated by the death of the narrator's mother. There is an awareness walking around the city that it's like a huge mausoleum, that the buildings house artifacts of the dead, paintings, that there's a strange feeling all around it, sepulchral, of the maintenance of a past life. And the book beautifully renders an experience that many writers feel can't be rendered because it is so ordinary and so ground level sad. Yet I loved this quality of quietness, of meditativeness, and I know that it took you, you were once not a writer who wrote draft after draft, but that this book took you many drafts to get right, and I wondered about that.
Well, you're right about Washington because it is a big cemetery in a way. Washington seems to me three things. It's a military barracks, it's a cemetery, and it's a think tank, you know, and all three things are going on at the same time. But the cemetery aspect is very apparent if you just walk the city. And that's what I was doing my first year in Washington. I was just walking the city. And there's something about Mary Todd Lincoln and about Henry Adams and about the past in Washington that, as you say, kind of glamorized what is really a pretty banal experience that that we all have, which is grief. There's a line in the book where the narrator asks the landlord, why do we care about the past? And he says, because it adds dignity to our paltry little lives or something. And that's what Washington does, I think, in the book, or for the narrator at least. There's a grandeur to Washington's cemetery aspects that his own little life didn't have. But I think that it was all unintentional on my part. I did take a long time to write this book. It took me 5 years to write 150 pages, and the reason was, I think, I didn't know what I was doing. All I could follow with those drafts was a kind of tone. Mm-hmm. There was something in the tone that I thought was worth saving. So when I was most discouraged by the book, when I said, you know, nothing hangs together, nothing's happening, you have no climactic whatever, there's no reveal, I thought, but I keep doing this because I come back to that strange tone. And the tone was involved with apprehending the city as he walks around.
What I found also moving is he seems to be finding in Mary Todd Lincoln's letters the memories of someone who has not stopped mourning. And around him, his friends and the people he's meeting have all found a way, if not to live, to move beyond mourning. So he's looking for famous mourners, people who make it possible for him to go on mourning for as long as he pleases, possibly the rest of his life. Now, is he in fact mourning for his mother, or is the mother just the final indignity?
I think it's what you just said. I was in Philadelphia at a reading, and one of the first questions that was asked was a man saying, isn't this book mistitled? This book isn't about grief. It's about untreated depression. And I said to him, well, yes, I think you're right. I said, you know, I didn't try to narrow it in any way. I just thought, take it as it is and you figure it out. I don't think the narrator is a model for anything in terms of grieving. The narrator is someone who is drawn to Mary Todd Lincoln because she didn't get over it. The narrator is drawn to this way you're not supposed to feel about grief, which is that you can't move on, that there's a point in time when you stop living almost because you know more people who are gone than are around. So I was drawn to some kind of perverse treatment of grief, and it had to do with Mary Todd Lincoln very much. There's a conversation between the narrator and his friend Frank when Frank says, look at Jackie Kennedy. Her husband was shot in front of her, and she moved on to a very productive and graceful second act. And they discuss the differences between the two women. But the narrator is absolutely drawn to the fact that Mary Todd Lincoln just got worse and worse and worse, really, as she went on. She was never able to shake it.
The narrator is nameless, but except for Frank and a dog and a cat, Biscuit and Sammy respectively, so is everyone else. It's practically an anonymous book, and as such, the eeriness that grows as page after page, people are known but not named, was fascinating to me. Why was that?
I have no idea. I mean, why didn't I name anybody else? I don't know. There are things that I'm hearing about this book that are surprises to me that I didn't know anything about. And I suppose, you know, that's Proust's idea, is that all writers must write out of the unconscious, that a novel of ideas is worthless. But I guess that's one of those things. I don't know why I did that. You make aesthetic choices, but you have no idea why. I'm glad it made it eerie in your opinion. That's good.
Well, it seemed to be resonant in that, on the one hand, they talk about anonymous sex, the characters do, versus intimacy. And yet, in this book in which people are seeking and fearing that intimacy is unavailable to them or that they wouldn't know how to cope with it if it came, the characters remain strangely anonymous. So the paradox seems to exert a tension on the book itself.
It is about ghostliness and about loneliness and about being adrift. In a curious way, the narrator is most at home with the homeless men on the benches around him. I myself look at homeless people often. I was walking down Santa Monica, the bluff today, looking at those people and thinking how, on the one hand, incredibly sad, and your heart goes out to them for the psychic situation that they're in. On the other hand, part of me looks at them and thinks, thank God, you know, you're stating a truth. You're recognizing something that no one else will recognize. You're the first person to mention Sammy the cat. And one of my favorite moments in the book is when he picks up the carrying case and he reads the sign on it, which goes something like, hi, my name is Sammy. I like people. I get dehydrated easily, so please give me a drink of water. And the narrator puts the traveling case down and says, that reminds me of everyone I know. And when I see a homeless man on a bench or woman, I think to myself, you're just saying something that the rest of us are constantly trying to disguise.
And that is, we need a home or we are home nowhere.
Both, I think. There's a wonderful line of Hannah Arendt that the task of man is to make a home for himself on earth. And I think that is so true. And this book is really about that. Mary Todd Lincoln never found a home for herself. All the years after Lincoln died, 16, I think, she was just a wanderer. And that is part of the narrator's experience in this book. And that's why the narrator feels something in common with homeless men. And that's why the narrator at one point, I think, says the way to escape Washington is to go down and lose yourself in a crowd of tourists, because they're wandering too.
I'm speaking with Andrew Holleran. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. Andrew Holleran's most recent book is Grief, published by Hyperion. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Andrew Holleran about his novel, Grief. Many of the books you've written really are covering your subjects for the first time. When Dancer from the Dance came out, it was a breakthrough novel because, in part, there really weren't other novels like it. And one of the things I recognized last night was going through the work, that recognition that chronicling a culture recently visible to the public eye always involves revelations that are brand new, and that even the massive deaths in The Beauty of Men and the recuperation from tragedy is something that had not been chronicled before, almost as if to stay true to one's experience means to be committed to the new, to the thing that has not yet been seen.
Well, when I wrote Dancer, I definitely had the feeling, an anthropological feeling in a way. I felt I'm describing a community, a little subculture that I don't think anyone has ever seen before. But as time went on, and Larry Kramer, who wrote Faggots at the same time, and then the Violet Quill group, Ed White and Felice Picano and others, Robert Farrow, began to be treated as pioneers, I was always looking for a chance to make the point that it wasn't quite that. I mean, Proust to me is, you can't call In Search of Lost Time a gay novel because people would laugh. But Proust was very conscious when he wrote that book that he was describing something new. He was afraid of doing it. He had full awareness of the fact that it might cost him his success. He was conscious of other novels that came out just before his that were on the same subject, because he felt he had a kind of gold mine, something really new and wonderful to describe. And that remains today. I mean, there's nothing fresher and more brilliant about the subject of homosexuality than the passages in Cities of the Plain and other parts of that book. But we forget that, you know, Satyricon, the Petronius Arbiter, has a gay plot. There were things like Totem Pole and Gore Vidal's City and the Pillar. There were many things. Balzac has a gay character. So it's been done before, but for some reason, the way the Violet Quill group, or what was called that, did it, was considered breakthrough, I guess, because this was possibly the first time gay men at least had decided to live together in a community with patterns and rituals, although you could argue that too. George Chauncey would say that was going on in New York in 1910 and et cetera. But it was perceived that these books were somehow writing about something that had not been treated before. I remember going to a party in New York after Dancer came out and an editor coming up and saying to me, you know, X number of years ago, this book could not have been published. But I wasn't conscious of it at the time. But once I got on that material, some part of me has felt obligated to continue with it. And there are many times when I've said, oh, get out of this, write something else. And I just can't.
I wondered, the subject concomitant with grief is the death of desire. And I think, again, one of the things about the death of desire is that it's so hard to write about. It involves renunciation, perhaps, but often surrender, sometimes abject. And I think that what becomes impressive about your books as the career goes along is that the subjects are difficult to word. The beautiful nouns and adjectives that once accompanied the human body when one flourished in desire for it disappear. And the writer has to almost do a Beckett-like surrender of the glorious description, the beautiful word. And you end up in grief in this sort of whited sepulcher city. Occasionally here and there, there's a headdress destined to a curio shop or bits. But for the most part, it's the beauty of finding words for the disappearance of the nouns of desire.
It's a much more elegant way than I can put it, but there's a line in Grief where the narrator is filling out an apartment for an application form for an apartment, and one of the entries is Project in Washington, and Frank turns to him and says, "Why don't you write Aging Homosexual Seeks to Reinvent Life?" And it does have to do. That is part of the book. He's coming to terms with the fact that when he walks down the street, no one looks at him. That incredible look that people live for a good portion of one's adult life, at least in gay life, I think, if not. I remember my mother, in fact, coming back from shopping one day when she was in her 60s, and she said, nobody looks at me anymore. And I was thunderstruck because you don't think of your parents as having any sexual vanity at all. But she had been used as a younger woman to turning heads, and they weren't anymore. And it happens to us all. And part of the gloom of grief, if it is untreated depression, is coming to terms with that.
But I'm asking about writing about it.
Ah, yes, the words that you can't use anymore in describing the body. Well, what you do is you transfer those adjectives to other things. You transfer them to music, to buildings, to weather, to your own moods, to everything but that, I guess. That's true.
Because it certainly, I think, is a Washington that hasn't been seen this way before. It's becomes a beautiful city of absence. You know, the narrator never mentions the present government. It's as if it's beneath his attention. And what we see, because of the after effect, the retinal image on the eye on completing this book, is things fading out. It's white under the moon, it's ghostliness, it's strange places, circles where people are waiting on benches, looking at one another, and homeless. Just a city that seems to be the locale for this novel, invented, reinvented, and described for this novel. Not the Washington, D.C. of the world, but the Washington, D.C. that awaits a funeral.
Again, I can't say anything as well as you have put it. I think it was unconscious. I'm thrilled that you're saying that. But in fact, Washington is like that after dark. If you walk down to those places after dark, you are alone. And it was the first thing that struck me about Washington when I started taking those walks, that I could be on Pennsylvania Avenue, this extremely long, rather important street, and there would be nobody on it. So Washington, after dark, when they've all gone back to the suburbs, is exactly like that. But I guess it did tie in with the fact that he was also grieving. I can't take credit for this consciously.
But I think that is the instinct. I mean, I think that if something is a work of art, that every choice made is a useful choice, that Washington becomes not the city of politics but the city of white, that this city cemetery, that the people become nameless, just as when you were walking in a cemetery, the names get forgotten. There are so many people you no longer know. That artistic instinct is to make usable for the effect of the work, as James would say, the procession of its effect, to not have anything excess, nothing that doesn't fit, and that the artistic mind is always editing out what's not useful to it.
Well, you've described the way the book was written. I initially, in the first draft, put in just about everything I had thought, heard, felt, or said about Washington, and over the next 5 years, it was a winnowing out. It was maintaining that tone I spoke of earlier, and I guess getting rid of everything else that was not that.
Is life that?
No, that's the paradox. That's the paradox. There's some famous story about Melville. I forget what it was, that after he finished Moby Dick, he came out and he said, "I have written a wicked book, but I feel as innocent as a lamb." I'm garbling the story. There's some schizophrenia about writing where you discharge the dark part and you're fine. No, life isn't like that. I love to joke and to have fun. So, and yet the part of me that wrote Grief was obviously present, or I wouldn't have written Grief. But there's something odd about writing where you discharge another self.
I've been speaking with Andrew Holleran, author most recently of Grief, published by Hyperion. Thank you, Andrew, for joining me.
Thank you very much.
You can read an excerpt from Grief on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Mario Diaz, with production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books will take you through the ages, back to days of old, when knights were bold, and books, 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 books can be funny too. Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time, to the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com, and copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing, books tell you everything, they're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.